Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us is Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. His books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, and India Since 1980. And his latest book, co-authored with S. Paul Kapoor, is India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumit Ganguly.
Good afternoon.
And Sumit, the world's biggest voting event is underway, with more than 800 million Indians going to the polls over the next 6 weeks to elect a new government. And the choices are between Narendra Modi, who's challenging, and he's with the BJP, a conservative, it's considered a Hindu fundamentalist party, which you can correct me if that's not the right way to describe it. And, of course, Rahul Gandhi, the vice president of the governing Congress party. Let's begin with Modi. He's already a pretty controversial character, in as much as the State Department are fairly leery of him. Where does that stand in terms of at least the U.S.'s relationship with Modi?
Well, the U.S. perforce will accommodate itself to Modi. It may not embrace him warmly if he becomes prime minister, but I think we'll manage to forge a working relationship with him, because you cannot afford to ignore the prime minister of India, especially when there is a defense relationship with India, substantial military-to-military contacts, arms sales. In addition to that, the prospects of growth in the Indian market, the possibilities of investment in India, and a substantial portion of the Indian diaspora, which is not averse to Modi. Under these circumstances, it's going to be exceedingly difficult to keep Modi at an arm's length. And quite frankly, the U.S. has dealt with far more scrofulous individuals when it has suited its interests. So I think we'll find a way to accommodate ourselves to Modi.
So the fact that the U.S. has already expressed skepticism, if not queasiness, about Modi, and given what happened recently, in fact, when we last spoke, over the arrest of the India Consul General in India's Consul General in New York over a matter involving the exploitation of a domestic servant, my understanding, and you were in Delhi, I think, when I talked to you, there was tremendous backlash in India, sort of anti-American, sort of nationalist backlash, if you will. So has America's condemnation or standoffish nature involved with their sense of Narendra Modi, has that played into nationalism and therefore helped him, since he's a fairly nationalistic, at least his party's very nationalistic, is it not?
That certainly has helped him, but it's not so much the American reaction. I don't think the vast majority of voters are even aware of what the United States thinks or does not think of Modi. It's simply Modi's emphasis on nationalist fervor, his pragmatic outlook, his emphasis upon jobs and growth, and also a general disgust with the Congress Party, which has been mired in one corruption scandal after another and has failed to deliver any form of governance over the last 5 years, when policy paralysis has been rampant in a whole series of areas, except the passage of some highly populist forms of legislation, which will and are in the process of draining the exchequer. In the absence of growth, or very anemic growth, coming up with vast social programs is not exactly a hallmark of sound governance. And Modi has highlighted particularly the scandal proneness of the Congress Party and the drift in economic policy, and is offering, though he has offered few specifics, he has highlighted these, and the general sense of disgust with Congress has redounded to Modi's advantage.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. And his books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons. And his latest book with S. Paul Kapoor is India, Pakistan and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. So just to sort of finish up on the U.S.'s disdain, displeasure, whatever the exact way to describe it is, with Modi, he, of course, is credited with fostering economic prosperity. He's a modernizer. He's somebody that's popular with the emerging tech sector in India. But he's also accused of not having done anything to stop the anti-Muslim riots in 2002, in which more than 1,000 people died. He's denied those allegations. What's your sense of whether that's a bum rap or not?
I am afraid there is a fair bit of evidence that suggests that even if he had not been complicit in the riots, and some would argue that he was actually complicit, but leaving aside for the moment whether he was actually complicit, there is little or no question that he did not move with alacrity to use state forces and police to quickly curb the riots and quickly offer protection to beleaguered Muslim communities. This much is quite clear. The real debate is the extent to which he was actually complicit or not.
So what's then the appeal in terms of nationalism? What does he and his party then, what are they tapping into? Again, going back to our last conversation over the backlash to the arrest of the Indian consular officer in New York over a domestic servant matter, my sense was and I think you told me at the time that people were not looking into the fact that she had mistreated her maid, but rather that she had been treated high-handedly by the Americans, and this had created a sort of patriotic backlash. So give me a sense of what's the engine of nationalism in the Indian context?
The engine of nationalism in the Indian context is a sense that India is not treated seriously enough by major powers, that the U.S. would not dare to treat, say, a European diplomat in this fashion, that this was somewhat callous on the part of the United States. And this was, of course, whipped up to some degree. I mean, it's not that it was entirely spontaneous. It was also, to some degree, orchestrated by the Ministry of External Affairs in New Delhi, which chose to make this an issue in Indo-U.S. relations and to really dwell on the issue and, make public statements which angered the people and linked it to also the searches of Indian high officials. And part of the problem is, you must understand, that Indian high officials are accustomed to having their way in certain venues where ordinary individuals like yourself or myself are subjected to fairly rigorous searches. And abroad, they don't seem to realize that even congressmen here in the United States, when flying to their constituencies, still have to go through a metal detector and are searched like everyone else. But they have this sense of privilege and a sense of their special prerogatives, which were, in their eyes, just blithely violated, especially because the diplomat was putatively covered under diplomatic immunity. And the whole debate sort of started to focus upon whether or not she actually enjoyed full diplomatic immunity, what diplomatic immunity entailed, and much of this information came directly from the Ministry of External Affairs, which felt that one of its members had been treated in a high-handed fashion, and especially when these diplomats are accustomed to a certain level of privilege back home in India. And they chose to focus mostly on the somewhat callous treatment, which I do happen to agree was callous, and a bit more discretion might have been used. But they chose solely to focus on the callous treatment and whip up public sentiment rather than conceding that she might have actually done something wrong. But the important thing to bear in mind that some of this nationalistic fervor that came to the fore was also the result of information coming from the government, which continued to highlight and underscore the seeming maltreatment of the diplomat and completely overlooking the fact that she was really at fault at some level.
So tell me about this other party, the Admi, which means the Common Man Party.
Yes.
What's happening there in terms of this, you know, emerging third party?
Well, their base of support is mostly urban. It's not entirely clear that they have a grassroots network outside urban areas. It's a relatively new phenomenon. They have not had enormous time to organize. Their sources of funding are limited because they are sort of the new kids on the block. They lack sort of the organizational base of the other two parties, but there is little question that they have struck a resonant chord amongst members of India's urban middle class, and many of them will probably bolt from both the Congress and the BJP and vote for the Aam Aadmi. Whether or not they will vote in droves for the Aam Aadmi across major metropolitan areas, that remains to be seen. That remains an open question. The Aam Aadmi certainly did not do itself any favors by only spending 49 days in office after a surprise victory in New Delhi when they resigned in a peak over their failure to pass some legislation because they were in a coalition regime. And the coalition, the members of the coalition, were stalling on the passing of this rather draconian anti-corruption law. And in a peak, they resigned, which I don't think burnished their credentials any.
But isn't the Aam Aadmi's party, that means the common man, isn't it resonating because their main mantra seems to be that they're against dynasty and politics, which is clearly, you know, aimed at the Gandhi family, who've more or less run India, I think, what's in the entire post-war era, with a few exceptions?
That's part of it, but much of their ire has been directed at corruption. Much more than dynastic politics, they have focused disproportionately on the widespread prevalence of corruption in Indian life, some of which has literally reached stratospheric proportions in recent years.
So back to the BJP, the Nationalist Party, and its leader who's challenging the Congress Party, Modi. He makes no secret I guess it's no secret that he has nationalistic views. But being from a Hindu nationalist party, I'm just having trouble trying to figure this out, Sumit, that he comes from a poor family at the bottom of the caste system. I guess, is he a Dalit? Is he what?
He's not.
No. So where is he in terms of the caste system?
He's not at the top of the hierarchy, but he's not at the bottom of the hierarchy either. He is basically a Baniya, which is a trading caste, and so does not face much of the social opprobrium that many from lower castes might face in certain constituencies.
So why then is he a nationalist if his own... is he against the class system that's inherent in the religion?
Nationalism is a form of appeal that cuts across social class, that cuts across region, that cuts across caste. Who could be opposed to being casting oneself as a staunch patriot and someone who is determined to make India proud? It's very difficult. It's only sort of, you know, contentious intellectuals like us who might look askance at a form of jingoism or chauvinism. The vast majority of people, even in advanced industrial states, fall prey to this kind of nationalist fervor. How many times does one hear this asinine statement in the United States that we are the greatest country in the world? It's the most vacuous statement. Greatest by what standard? Do we have the best healthcare system in the world? Do we have the best primary education system in the world? Are we best known for reducing dramatic economic inequity in this country? I would say we fall flat on all three. But yet, any number of my fellow American citizens are enamored of this notion of being the greatest nation on earth, even though their own circumstances might actually belie that.
So give us a sense then who Modi might be like in our political lexicon. Would he be like a Ted Cruz?
Oh, I would definitely compare Modi to a Ted Cruz or a Marco Rubio of that ilk, and with elements of Sarah Palin thrown in for good measure.
Good Lord. No wonder the State Department is skeptical of him.
Well, the thing is, though, that unlike Sarah Palin, who is not exactly known for her stellar intelligence, Modi is actually, while I decry his ideology and his outlook, I cannot deny that Modi has a certain level of astuteness and a certain adroitness which Sarah Palin might lack.
So what's your sense then of what his chances are in terms of overturning this Congress Party dynasty? As beset it is with a scandal, there's still a certain inertia there in that electorate, isn't it?
Well, I think that inertia is going to actually result in a form of sluggishness. And I think the disgust with Congress is so overwhelming, except in a set of fairly stable constituencies which have long voted for Congress and still have some residual sympathy for the dynasty or have fallen prey to the Congress's welfaristic schemes and populist schemes, I think Congress is in for a very serious drubbing. Even though the BJP's votes may be siphoned off to some degree by regional political parties, thereby denying them an outright majority.
So who will they form a coalition with then, assuming that you think that they will end up governing India?
Whoever is willing to join hands with them, any number of regional parties with the lure of a certain amount of power in New Delhi and the possibility of being able to feed at the trough of the Indian treasury will probably line up to join them. The communists, of course, will not have any truck with the BJP. Mamata Banerjee in West Bengal has said she will not join a BJP government, though with under certain financial inducements, I'm sure she can be persuaded to change her mind, especially after the election is over and she doesn't need the Muslim vote in Bengal for another 5 years. People like Jayalalitha Jayaram in the state of Tamil Nadu in the south will probably, if not join the government, allow some of her members to join the government, some of the members of her party to join the government. There are other parties in the north that might be willing to make common cause. So he will have a choice of coalition partners. I don't think there will be a significant death.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. His books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, and India Since 1980. And his latest book, co-authored with S. Paul Kapoor, is India, Pakistan and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the rise of the right wing in Hungary.